Well, as you can see from the opening slide that's up there, I want to talk a bit about not only Jerusalem, but about the Temple Mount in specific. I've been able to visit there several times, and it is one of the most interesting places that I've ever been on earth. How many of you have ever been to Jerusalem? See some hands. If you ever get the opportunity to, it will completely change how you read the Bible. You will never, ever read it the same way again. You'll get into the section in the book of Acts where Paul gets called and where he went through some of the trials that he did. And you'll be able to see and to visit some of those places, and it will just make it come alive. As a result of being able to visit there a few times, I just got this intense interest in it. And it is such a precious thing to be able to have visited there. The Temple Mount in Jerusalem, however, is one of the most contested pieces of real estate on earth. How did it get to be such a problem? We know in Scripture that God said that Jerusalem would be a cup of trembling, but how did this little piece of real estate, it's actually around 37 acres that we call the Temple Mount area, how did it get to be so cantankerous and with so much turmoil? What's the story behind this piece of real estate that dominates this ancient city? And as we look at the millennial reign of Jesus Christ, how will this piece of real estate be used in the future? So what I want to do tonight, I want to give you a history lesson. Some of you really like history and some of you really don't. If you're really tired and you have trouble and you go to sleep, I understand. But hopefully I'll do my best to make this as entertaining as I can, as well as informative. So we will go through a history lesson of this site, talk about present day, but then I also want to look at the prophecies in the future about what God has in store for this 37 acres that is so hotly contested today. So let's go into the discussion of Jerusalem, Jerusalem. I want to start with a scripture. I've got all the scriptures on the slides tonight. I wasn't exactly sure how the lighting would work, so I wanted to make sure they were all on slides. When Jesus Christ spoke these words, he actually was on the Temple Mount area. Let's look and see what he said. Matthew 23, verses 37 through 39. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who were sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate, for I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Now, there is a lot in these three verses that is very, very easy to read over. I want you to think about the fact of who he was and where he was. This is Jesus Christ. You know who he was. He was the God of the Old Testament. He was the one that spoke to Abraham. He was the one that spoke to Moses. He was the one that spoke to Noah. When he gave the law on Mount Sinai, that was the one who became Jesus Christ. John 1:1 and John 1:14 tell us that. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. This is the one who had seen this piece of real estate from start to finish. And he's standing on it and he's saying, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I wanted to gather you, to protect you, to keep you. He says in here, over the centuries, I sent prophets to you. I sent prophetesses to you. I punished you. I blessed you. I tried to get you to understand, but you wouldn't listen. And guess what? They weren't listening again. He's standing on the Temple Mount as the one who was God in the flesh, and they weren't listening to him again. He desired to gather them up and place them in safety in their homeland. But for their sins, he knew that they would lose the temple. Now, the temple was standing at the time, but notice what he says in here. Your house is left desolate. He knew that something was coming. He knew that they were going to lose the Temple Mount once again. For their sins, he knew they would not only lose the temple, but the very place where he was standing would be torn to the ground. They would be removed from Jerusalem itself. Until one day when it said that he would come back, and then the people would know who he really was. Now, I want you to notice, the chapter break in the Bible is not real. It's something that There've been a lot of stories about how chapter breaks got set up in the Bible, but when you go from the end of Matthew 23 to the start of Matthew 24, you see something very interesting. So he is on the Temple Mount. He has just made this statement. And now look at the very next thing that he says. Then, right? Then, right after he made these statements, Jesus, let me get to the right page of mine. Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to show him the buildings of the temple. Isn't that interesting? Jesus Christ had just, in essence, prophesied that they would lose this building, and yet they're talking about this great temple project that Herod had started in 19 BC, and they were redoing it, and they were reformatting it, and all these, you know, artisans were around, and it must have been a very exciting time. And his disciples came to show him the building of the temple. And Jesus said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say unto you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down." If you would, I would like for you to imagine what Jesus Christ must have felt when he made that statement. He was the one that saw it from the very beginning. He saw all of the temples being built. He saw all the reconstruction. He saw all of the sins. He saw all of the prophets that he had sent. He gave the prophecies to the prophets to tell them, you're about to lose this land. You're about to lose this building. Repent. And yet they still wouldn't do it. How hard would it be for him to stand up there to his disciples and say, it's going again. They're going to lose it again. That had to have been tough in one sense for him to be able to do that. And yet all the disciples could see was a magnificent structure. They couldn't see past that, but they would very soon. There's an ancient document called the Midrash. This is some ancient Jewish writings. It's a commentary of the Hebrew scriptures. And they make a very interesting statement here. And this is going to kind of be the center of what I want to talk about today. This is a quote from the Midrash. "As the navel is set in the center of the human body, so is the land of Israel the navel of the world. Situated in the center of the world, Jerusalem in the center of the land of Israel, the sanctuary in the center of Jerusalem, the holy place in the center of the sanctuary, and the ark in the center of the holy place, and the foundation stone before the holy place, because from it the world was founded." Now, if you take that for what it means, many people in the Jewish faith believe that Adam and Eve were created over this rock where the Ark of the Covenant stood. Now, I don't think that the church would agree with that. Probably the place where the Garden of Eden was would have been someplace else. But interestingly enough, from Jewish lore, the center of the universe, as it were, is a stone that is sitting on top of a mountain in Jerusalem. It is a special site to God. It is a special site to Judaism. And it's that site that we're going to talk about today. For the purposes of this study, let's explore this place that has been such a central focus of Jewish history for thousands of years. You'll see from the Bible that many events that we read about occurred on this very spot. Sometimes we don't realize that. We think, well, that's where the temple is and nothing else happened there. There were a lot of things that happened on top of this rock. We're going to talk about that today. We will also see from history that this piece of property, this rock, changed hands a dozen or more times over the last 2,000 years. After the death of Jesus Christ and the destruction of the temple, it has gone from one group to another. But we also know that this place is prophesied to be at the center of end time events. And past that, we know that during the millennium, Jesus Christ will rule from this spot. So what we want to do today is talk about the history of the place, what is going on today, and then let's go into some prophecies to talk about what's going to happen to this place in the near future. I'm going to put a picture up here and ask you if you know what this is a picture of. Think back to your Bible literature. You've got a man who's got his son on a table, and he's about to slit his throat, and an angel's stopping him, and you can see the ram in the background. This is Abraham being told by God to sacrifice Isaac. Where was this place? You ever wondered about that? Let's read. Let's go in and read what it says in the Bible. Genesis chapter 22. I'm going to start in verse 2, and I'm just going to pick up three verses here. Verse 2, verse 9, and verse 14. Then he, God, said, now remember who this God was. This is the God of the Old Testament. This is the one who would become Jesus Christ. Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah. Where's the land of Moriah? If you'd go to Google Maps now and type in land of Moriah, I'm not sure where it would take you. It might be interesting to see. But where is the land of Moriah? And offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Now get the significance behind who's saying this. This is the God who is going to come in the future and be sacrificed himself. And he's telling Abraham, you in type do what I'm going to do in the near future. Verse 9, then they came to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built an altar there. Remember this word altar, it's going to come up again and again and again. Abraham built an altar there, placed the wood on the altar, and he bound Isaac his son, laid him on the altar and upon the wood. And Abraham, verse 14, called the name of the place, the Lord will provide. This was after the angel stopped him. Abraham called the name of the place, the Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord, or the mount of the eternal, it shall be provided. So again, where is this place? Abraham is instructed to go to a certain mountain, Mount Moriah, and offer Isaac as a sacrifice. You know, if there were no other biblical references to this, we may never know where this was. But fortunately, there are several other events that occur in the Bible that help us understand precisely where this spot was. So let's go a little further in the story, and let's read another account, this time in 1 Chronicles chapter 21. What's this a picture of? If I were to show this to you, what do you think this is? Think back to the history of the Bible. Do you remember when David was moved to number Israel, and God was very displeased, and God sent an angel with a flaming sword, and thousands of Israelites were being slaughtered by this angel. And David saw the angel. You can see King David there on the left-hand side of the slide with his crown on, and he's bowing and he's praying to God, please stop this. So this is the time when David numbered Israel and angered God. Now let's read what it says in 1 Chronicles chapter 21, verses 15, 18, and 19, because we get another clue about another place. Then God sent an angel to Jerusalem to destroy it. This happens over and over and over again. If God tells us that we obey, we will be blessed, and if we disobey, then we will have cursings brought upon us. David was instructed what he should and shouldn't do as a king, and when David did what God did not want him to, then God was intent to send an angel to destroy Jerusalem. As he was destroying, the Eternal looked, and he relented of the disaster, and he said to the angel who was destroying, it is enough, now restrain your hand. And the angel of the Eternal stood by the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. Where's the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite? You know what a threshing floor is, right? That's where you winnow the grain, you take it, and you put it on a basket or something, and you throw it up in the air, and the wind takes the chaff away and drops the heavier grain. Just to get an idea of where this usually occurred, a threshing floor was usually just below the top of a knoll in a hill, because the wind would come over the top and then down, and it was a perfect place to do winnowing. So it usually wasn't at the very top, it was a few feet down. So this threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite would be just below this rock wherever he was, and this was the area where he was threshing grain. It was right over the top of this area where he was threshing grain that the angel's hand was stayed. The angel of the Lord stood by the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, verse 18. Therefore the angel of the Eternal commanded Gad to say to David that David should go and erect an altar. So here we see an altar again. There's another altar that's going to be built to the Eternal on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. So David went up at the word of Gad, which he had spoken in the name of the Eternal. So an angel is sent to slaughter the Israelites. God stops him right at a certain spot. And then the angel tells David, on this spot, you build me an altar. And David obeys, as you'll see in just a moment. Let's go on to 1 Chronicles 21 and verse 22. 21, 22, there we go. Then David said to Ornan, grant me the place of this threshing floor that I may build an altar on it to the Lord. Didn't belong to David. David didn't own this. The city of David was a little bit further south, and he was in control of that. But this particular piece of real estate belonged to someone else. And now the Lord, the angel of the Lord, has told David to build an altar there, but it wasn't David's property. So David goes to Ornan and says, grant me the place of the threshing floor that I may build an altar on it to the Eternal. You will grant it to me at full price that the plague may be withdrawn from the people. And I don't quote it all here, but he and Ornan haggle back and forth. Ornan actually tries to give it to him for free, but David insists that he must pay for it. Verse 25. So David gave Ornan 600 shekels of gold by weight for the place, and David built there an altar to the Eternal and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings, and he called on the Eternal, and he answered from heaven by fire on the altar of burnt offering. So God instructed him to build an altar there. David builds an altar there, offers an offering, a sacrificial offering, a sin offering. We know it was a sin offering because it was a burnt offering, and God appreciates the fact that David has done this and gives him a miraculous sign. He sends fire from heaven to consume the area by the altar or the altar itself. So David builds an altar on the site and offers many types of offerings, burnt offerings and peace offerings. God is obviously present at this place because he honors David's sacrifice with fire. Was this place ever used again? The threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. Well, the Bible does tell us in another event that this place, this threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, would be used yet once again. So let's go a little bit further and let's look at another picture. This is now David's son, King Solomon. This is a kind of a graphic representation of it. Remember that David said to God, I want to build you a temple. And God said, why would you want to do that? I'm perfectly happy with the tabernacle. You'll see a picture of it in a moment. And David said, no, this is something that I want to do. And God said, well, you're not going to build it. You've been a very bloody man, but wait, I will allow your son Solomon to build it. So David makes a lot of plans, as we'll see in just a moment. And here's a depiction of the beginning of the building of the temple. Let's go to 2 Chronicles chapter 3 in verse 1. And we'll tie these first two events together. Now Solomon began to build the house of the Eternal at Jerusalem on Mount Moriah. That was from where? From Abraham when he sacrificed Isaac. It was on Mount Moriah, where the Eternal had appeared to his father David at the place that David had prepared on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. So guess what? Mount Moriah from Abraham's time, the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, the place where David built an altar to God, and the place where Solomon built the temple of God are all the same place, on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Mount Moriah, interestingly enough, in Hebrew means a place chosen by God. God sent Abraham to a specific spot. This is where you sacrifice your son. He told the angel, stop at this spot. He told David, build an altar on this spot. And then David instructs Solomon, on this spot is where you will put the altar for the new temple that I want built. This small piece of real estate has a very powerful past, and we're going to see that it's going to have a very powerful future as well. Sometimes, again, when we read the Bible, we don't kind of put these things together and realize that these all happened in the same spot. But years later, King Solomon has an aggressive building project, and he would build a temple to God on the same spot that had been used many times in the past. Now I want to go back a bit and take a brief journey in the history of Israel. You remember when they came out of the land of Egypt and they were wandering in the wilderness, that they had a pillar of fire by day or by night and a cloud by day that they would follow. But at some point in time, God directed them that they were to build a tent-like tabernacle that they could take down and bind up and then transport to another site. And then when God would say, you know, this is it, I want you to stay here for a while, then they would put the tabernacle back together. So Moses was instructed, and he was given very specific instructions on how to build this tent tabernacle so that they could take it around with them. And you see a representation here on the slide of what it may have looked like. So as Israel wandered through the wilderness and they built this portable tabernacle, it was a place where they would house the Ark of the Covenant, and it would be a central place where God's presence would reside. I want you to notice what happens, and you're going to see this again and again and again in Scripture, when the tabernacle first gets dedicated. Let's go to Exodus chapter 40. Exodus chapter 40, we're going to read verse 1, verse 17, and verse 34. Exodus chapter 40, and verse 1. Then the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, "On the first day of the first month, you will set up the tabernacle of the tent of meeting." Verse 17, it came to pass in the first month of the second year, on the first day of the month, that the tabernacle was raised up. And then in verse 34, then the cloud covered the tabernacle of meeting, and the glory of the Eternal filled the tabernacle. This cloud had been with them the whole time, but after they set the tabernacle up, the cloud didn't just go anywhere. The cloud resided at the spot where the Holy of Holies was inside this tabernacle that they would take with them. And every time the Israelites were to move, that presence of God would move, and then they would realize, oh, it's time to go, and they would wrap the tabernacle up, and they would go until that presence stopped again, and then they would put the tabernacle back up, and then the presence of God would reside in the Holy of Holies where the Ark of the Covenant was. So once the tabernacle was set up, God's presence would descend into this Holy of Holies, and then it would be moved from place to place. But this place in the desert of Sinai wasn't where God intended for the Holy of Holies, for the Ark of the Covenant, and for his presence to remain. There would be a lot of movement of the Ark of the Covenant for a while, but it would end up in a specific place. Where do you think that specific place will be? We'll read about it as we go forward. So again, here's a picture of Solomon building this temple. Let's turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 22, and let's read verse 6 through 11. 1 Chronicles 22. Then David called for his son Solomon and charged him to build a house for the Eternal God of Israel. The word of the Eternal came to me, David says, saying, "Behold, a son will be born to you, who shall be a man of rest, and I will give him rest from all of his enemies all around." The name of Solomon is similar to the word shalom, which means peace or rest. "For I will give peace and quietness to Israel in his days, and he will build a house for my name, and he will be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever. Now, my son," David says, "may the Eternal be with you, and may you prosper, and build the house of the Eternal your God." So David, as we know, made as many preparations as he could. He talked to Hiram, he talked to other people, "Give me wood, give me stone," and he set up as much as he could in advance, knowing that he would not be the one to build it. I imagine that David hired architects to help design it, and everything was ready for when Solomon would finally build it. This would be, as we will find out, the same location as David had erected an altar in the years earlier after the angel had been stopped from slaughtering any further Israelites. 1 Kings 6, verse 1. 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 1, "It came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is in the second month, that he began to build the house of the Eternal." Now think about where God's presence has been all this time. For 480 years, it had traveled. For 40 years, it had wandered in the wilderness. And then after they had come into the land of Israel, it was in Shiloh for a while. It was in this place. It was in that place. The Ark of the Covenant even was with the Philistines for a while, if you'll remember that story, where they came and stole it and put it in the house of Dagon. You remember that story where the statue of Dagon kept falling down and bowing down to the Ark of God? But finally, 480 years after Israel had left the land of Egypt, Solomon begins to build on this very site a house to God. Drop down to chapter 6, or to 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 12. Here is a picture of what the temple may have looked like. There are a lot of different renditions of it. The Bible gives some explanations of it. You'll see later on that this is very interesting, that we only get a snapshot of it. There's a lot of description of what the tabernacle would look like. There's some descriptions of what the temple would look like. We know its basic construction, the Holy of Holies was so many cubits by so many cubits, and the temple was so many by so many, and there's a room here and a place there. The altar would be in front. The laver where you do the washing was in front of that even, and it was all set up. So from that, people have taken renderings of it and tried to come up with what they think the Temple of Solomon may have looked like when it was completed. Let's read about that completion. 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 12 through 14. So concerning this temple which you are building, if you walk in my statutes, you execute my judgments, and you keep all my commandments and walk in them, then I will perform my word which I spoke to your father David, and I will dwell among the children of Israel, and I will not forsake my people Israel. So Solomon built the temple and finished it. Now there's a couple of things in here that may be real easy to read over. What does God say about his dwelling in this temple? It is contingent upon their obedience. I want to read this again. If you walk in my statutes, I'm going to keep using the word if here for emphasis, if you execute my judgments, if you keep my commands, if you walk in them, then I will perform what I have spoken to your father David, and I will dwell among the children of Israel. So as long as they did what God instructed them to do, somehow his presence, as it had been with them in the wilderness, would be with them once this temple was finished. God promised he would bless Israel if they would obey him. And with those promises, Solomon finishes the temple construction at the site of Mount Moriah, on the site of Ornan the Jebusite, on the site where David built an altar, and on the site where he instructed Solomon to build this temple. 1 Kings chapter 8, in verse 6, it says, the priest brought the Ark of the Covenant of the Eternal into his place, into the oracle of the house, to the most holy place, even under the wings of the cherubim. The Holy of Holies had been in the tabernacle. Then for a while it was in the house of a priest. It had been here, it had been there. But finally, it was going to be in its final resting place, at least the nation of Israel hoped, in the most holy place, in the Holy of Holies, in the temple. Notice what happens, verse 10. And it came to pass, when the priests were come out of the holy place, that the cloud filled the house of the Eternal, so that the priests could not continue ministering because of the cloud, for the glory of the Eternal had filled the house of the Eternal. So once again, this Shekinah glory, this presence of God, was with Israel and in a specific spot. It now wasn't traveling around as the tabernacle was traveling around. It wasn't leading ahead of the children of Israel because they were in the promised land. But now they had a temple, they had a holy of holies, they had the cherubim, they had everything set up, they had the Ark of the Covenant there. And once Solomon prayed to God and said, bless this place, God pronounced his acceptance of his residence in this place by filling his presence. The glory of the Eternal had filled the house of the Lord. You know, God's presence at this site was not unique to this visit. I want you to think about the other things that we read earlier and imagine. Was God present when Abraham was told to sacrifice Isaac? You remember he says, now I know. Who do you think was talking? Now I know. God's presence was at Mount Moriah. When the angel of the Lord was there, and God said, stop. Stop right there. And the angel said, God wants you to build an altar here. God's presence was at that site. Now, as the temple is built, God's presence is once again at this site. You're going to see many more opportunities for this to happen at this very site. God was there with Abraham's sacrifice. It was evident when God sent fire, when David built his altar, that his presence was there. And God was again placing his presence as the Ark of the Covenant was in what they hoped would be its final resting place. Interestingly enough, if you want to date, the temple was dedicated around 953 BC. Not that that date has any significance to the rest of the Bible study, but it helps set a marker in history of how long the Ark of the Covenant actually stayed there. So, from the death of Solomon until Nebuchadnezzar, what happens to this site? Well, if you read through 1 Kings, 2 Kings, even 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, you'll see a repeating pattern. I can remember Mr. Armstrong talking about this. Israel would obey, God would bless them. Leader would die, Israel would sin, God would punish them. They would cry out to God, he would send them a leader, they would repent, he would forego, the leader would die, and they'd start to sin again. And this went back and forth and back and forth. How did the temple fare in Israel? Just give you a kind of a brief history of it. If you'll remember, after Solomon died, when Rehoboam took over, the temple was raided by Shishak of Egypt, and the treasuries used to pay tribute to foreign kings came from the temple treasuries itself. So Rehoboam didn't do a very good job. You remember King Manasseh, one of the worst kings ever, put pagan shrines in the temple itself. Just an abomination to God. And Ahaz also built an altar to a pagan god inside the area of the temple. So remember God's promise to them, if you stay faithful to me, I will continue to have my presence here. But they didn't do it. So let's look and see what finally happens. This is again is a picture of this this temple area that Solomon had built. 2 Kings chapter 25, verses 8 through 10, we see what finally happens. Nebuchadnezzar looted and then burned the temple in 587 BC. Let's read about it. 2 Kings 25. In the fifth month, on the seventh day of the month, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, and he burned the house of the Eternal and the king's house and all of the houses of Jerusalem, that is, all of the houses of the great he burned with fire. And all the army of the Chaldeans who were with the captain of the guard broke down the walls of Jerusalem all around. So Nebuchadnezzar loots and burns the temple in 587 BC, built in 953 approximately, and destroyed in 587. Not a very long period of time, but the temple, the first temple, was there for a while. The temple stood approximately 400 years and then got destroyed. The Ark of the Covenant, interestingly enough, disappears from history at this time, never to return back to the Temple Mount project. The temple gets rebuilt, but the Ark of the Covenant doesn't go back in there. I find that interesting. Think about that from the perspective of the Day of Atonement. What was the high priest supposed to do on the Day of Atonement? He was supposed to take blood from a lamb and go behind the curtain and sprinkle it on the Holy of Holies. What happened after this period of time? The high priest would go in and sprinkle that blood in thin air. There was no ark there. He would do it, but there was obviously something that was going to have to happen in the future because the Ark of the Covenant and the presence of God was no longer in that place. So Mount Moriah, the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, David's altar, and Solomon's temple was once again without the presence of God. It had been there four times up to this point in four different occasions, but now the presence of God was gone again. Now what I want to do is go forward in time another 70 years. What had God promised to Judah through many of the prophets? I'm going to send you into Babylonian captivity, but in 70 years you will be able to return. So 70 years later, through Ezra and Nehemiah, we know that people were able to return and to see what was left of the temple that had been destroyed. Now, I would imagine most of them didn't know what they would expect. They were taken into captivity, perhaps even before the final burning of the city of Jerusalem. They had been gone for 70 years, so this would now be a couple of generations away. There may have still been a few people that were alive that could tell them what it looked like. But again, it would have been a distant memory, and those that went back would not have had a real clear picture of what they were expecting. Yet we know that there were a few old-timers that did return, as we'll read here in just a moment. Let's go to 2 Kings chapter 3. Here, by the way, getting ahead of myself, is a kind of a representation of them coming back and looking at what was left of the temple. Now, if you can imagine the artist's depiction here, at the very top you see the old burned out hulk of what was left of the original temple that Solomon built, and then the reconstruction or the trying to put it back together. You also see what was probably Ezra there asking prayers to God. You see other people praying, but you see some other people that are wailing. They're not very happy. So let's read what it says in Ezra chapter 3 about this. In 537, we know that BC, that exiles took some of the vessels that were looted by Nebuchadnezzar and returned to Jerusalem and erected an altar. The temple was refinished around 516. Let's read about it. Ezra 3, verse 10. The builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Eternal, and all of the people shouted with a great shout. This is just the foundation now. This is not the whole building. This is just the start. You know how sometimes you have a ceremony when you lay the first cornerstone of a building and you have a ceremony. That's what they were doing. When they praised the Eternal, because the foundation of the house of the Eternal was again laid. But many of the priests and Levites and head of the fathers' houses, old men who had seen the first temple, wept with a loud voice when the foundation of the temple was laid before their eyes. Yet many others, probably the younger guys, shouted aloud for joy. Why are you crying? We're building a new temple. Well, they obviously were very sad because they remember what the first temple looked like. Yet many shouted aloud for joy so that the people could not discern the noise of the shouts of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. That must have been kind of strange. You're hearing all this noise and you don't know whether this is a happy noise or a sad noise. Ever heard any of you parents have kids and you hear them in the back and they're screaming and yelling and you think, are they screaming for joy or has someone just gotten hurt? I imagine that's probably what Ezra was wondering. Okay, is this a good noise or a bad noise? For the people shouted with a loud shout and the sound was heard afar off. The Ark of the Covenant, again, by this time had disappeared. When they finished this temple a second time, there was no Ark of the Covenant to be able to place inside it again. In fact, the Ark of the Covenant disappears. Now, I know a lot of you probably out there have theories on where it is, and that's fine. There have been a lot of even National Geographic and other programs that have tried to figure out where it is. But what I can tell you is it wasn't here. Not during this time when they built it together. There was no Shekinah glory of God that returned to the Holy of Holies at this time. Maybe because there wasn't an Ark of the Covenant. God did, even though they were allowed to go back and fill it again to rebuild it and to start the temple worship, the presence of God did not show back up at that time. Jewish captives were allowed to return to their land. They worshiped at the temple. But this sacred place suffers again many twists and turns after the Old Testament period comes to a close. Now, we call it the intertestamental period, if you know what I'm talking about. When the Old Testament closes, it's, and I'm just going to guess at a date, maybe 300 or 400 B.C. And then Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John starts in 4 B.C. or so. So we've got 300 or 400 years where we don't have anything that is explicitly in our Bible. But we do know a lot of what happened there because of some of the apocrypha that is written during that time, the book of the Maccabees, etc. And what we find out from those books and from other histories, in 167 BC, you remember the story of Antiochus Epiphanes desecrates the temple by setting up a pagan shrine in the Holy of Holies. We're going to read about that event that will happen again in the future. But by 164 BC, the Maccabees had cleansed the temple and had tried to set it all back to its right way again. Many twists and turns occurred along this very serious piece of real estate. But again, God's glory was not there at the time. Now, we go into the future, and Herod decides that he is going to try and rebuild this temple. It had been knocked down. It had been rebuilt by Ezra and Nehemiah. It had been kind of knocked down or suffered again. The Maccabees had done what they could to fix it back up, but it wasn't in the best condition. So in 19 BC, Herod starts a building project, and he's going to expand the platform of the Temple Mount. I'm not going to discuss that in too much detail right now because I've got some slides in just a little bit that'll show you what I mean by that. But he decides that he is going to try and rebuild this to try and get the glory of Jerusalem and the glory of Israel back to where he wanted it to be. Many people would say that the glory of God never again returned to this temple because the Ark of the Covenant wasn't there. But I'm here to tell you that I think it did. I want to show you something that perhaps you haven't thought about when you've read some of these scriptures. When the Pharisees were scolding Christ for breaking the Sabbath, I don't know if you remember this, he said something very, very interesting to them. I want to turn to Matthew chapter 12. Let's read verse 6 and 7. As he's standing at the Temple Mount being scolded by the Pharisees, he makes this statement, Matthew 12, verse 6 and 7. Have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath day the priests went into the temple and profaned the Sabbath by eating the bread that they shouldn't have eaten and were blameless? Yet I say to you that in this place, where was he? He was on the Temple Mount. In this place is one greater than the temple. The one who was the God of the Old Testament, the one who was the presence that shone above the tabernacle and then above the temple and above the altar that David built and appeared on this very spot with Abraham, that very being was back on the Temple Mount. He did not go in the Holy of Holies, not then, but his presence was there, and they missed it. I say that a lot when I go through things, especially around the Passover time. It's always amazing to me. They were looking for the Messiah at that time. They knew from the prophecies that he was supposed to come right around that period of time. And he was standing in the temple, the very presence of God, and they missed it. So I would tell you that the presence of God was there, although not in a way that they would have recognized it, because it wasn't his time. In fact, as he was standing, again, I'll put it back, we had it up here before, as he was standing at the Temple Mount, remember what he said in Matthew 24, verse 2, we read it earlier, verily I say unto you, there will not be left one stone upon another that won't be thrown down. The presence of God was on the Temple Mount, but he wasn't going to go into the Holy of Holies, not then. That wasn't his time. In fact, he knew that this temple would again be destroyed. Jesus knew that his glory that was there at that moment wouldn't stay there. He had to die. He had to be resurrected. He had to go back to the throne of God to come another time. But he would come back to this very spot, and his presence would be there once again. But I'm getting ahead of the story. Let's wait. But he, again, also knew that this temple would be completely destroyed. Here's one artist's rendition of what happened. Just probably 39 years after Jesus Christ died, the Jewish leaders of the day decide that they don't like Roman rule anymore. Now, again, if you remember their interpretation of the Old Testament Messiah, they thought that he was going, it would be just be a man, kind of like an Elijah or whatever, and that he would come and he would kick the Romans out so that they could then be self-sufficient and rule themselves again. They weren't thinking about a kingdom of God or anything like that in the future or a millennial reign. What they were thinking of was, let's get these Romans out because we're Jews after all and we should be in control of our own land. So after the Messiah didn't appear like they thought, then they decided to take matters into their own hands, and they rebelled against the Romans, and the Romans don't like to be rebelled against. And they took matters into their own hands, and they sacked the place. The Romans burnt the city, and the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, and the spoils of the temple were carried to Rome. Again, reading from some historical references of the time, it says, thus the Romans protracted an unrelenting siege that ended what had been a flourishing and splendid city. Jerusalem's buildings were put to the torch and its inhabitants exiled. Once again, the site that was chosen by God did not have a temple on it, and it was destroyed. This is, by the way, I don't know if any of you have ever gone to Rome to see this. This is on Titus's arch in Rome, and it is a depiction of the temple being looted. You can see the menorah and other tape. There's the table that the showbread was on there, and some of the horns, the trumpets that were blown were taken. So this is a depiction of Titus as he sacks Jerusalem in 70 AD, and many of the things that were a part of the temple practice are gone forever, never to be returned. Keep that picture of the menorah in your mind, because I've got another slide in a little while to whet your appetite on things that are going to happen in the future. So here we have 70 AD, just 39 years or so after Jesus Christ dies. What he said would happen happened. And that spot that was chosen by God is again desolate and doesn't have anything to represent him or the nation of God. Now, for the sake of time, I'm going to go through the next couple thousand years pretty quickly. We could be here all night if I would go through in exquisite detail what happened. But you obviously see this picture of the Dome of the Rock. This is a picture that I took in 2005. It's a magnificent building. I tell you the story, I almost got inside. There are some people, maybe even people in here that actually did get to go inside. The year that I went, nobody was allowed inside. Shamelessly, I bribed a guard with $20 to be able to go inside. And so he didn't take the money. He just pointed to a shoebox and just put it there. So I dropped the money in, and he pointed at my shoes. I had to take the shoes off. So I took the shoes off, and I started to walk through the door. And this elderly lady that was one of the guardians of the Dome of the Rock came outside, and we met eye to eye. And I have no idea what she said after that, but I have a feeling that I probably didn't want a translation. So I turned back around and put my shoes on, and then she started yelling at the guard whom I had bribed. So almost started an international incident. So, but anyway, let's give you a little history about what happens to this area. I've just got a couple of bullet points, and we'll talk through some of these. In 135 AD, Emperor Hadrian declares this new city on the site of Jerusalem, and he calls it by a more Anglican name, Colonia Aelia Capitolina. So it's at this point in time no longer called Jerusalem, and Emperor Hadrian now has this for the glory of Rome. In 153 AD, the Jews are now not permitted to go back inside the city. Now, this is important. I know there are a lot of people that have their theories on where the Temple Mount was, and some people would disagree with some of my conclusions on this. But one of the reasons why it's so hard to know with precision is because you're going to see that over 2,000 years, a lot of those 2,000 years, the Jews were not allowed to be in the city. Now, you can imagine, have you ever gone back to your old neighborhood that you grew up in and maybe the house was torn down, or like the place where I was born? The hospital is a parking lot for a high school now. And when I would go back, I wouldn't be able to see what happened to it. And that was just a few years down the road. Imagine being gone for 2,000 years and all you've got is history books that were written at the time. And you go back and try and figure out where something is. It's one of the reasons why it's so very hard to get a precise understanding of it. The Jews were not permitted to enter Jerusalem. Christianity was still a forbidden religion, so it was completely taken over by the Romans. In 638 AD, Jerusalem again gets surrounded, but this time to the forces of a rising power on the stage of history. This is the time when the Muslim Arabs come in and they start to take over the Holy Land. This is 638 AD. The Dome of the Rock actually gets built in 687 AD. If you've never heard the story behind it, according to the Quran, the angel Gabriel tells Muhammad to go to the top of the great rock on the Temple Mount, where he is ascended to heaven. He sees paradise and hell. He meets figures from the Bible and, by the way, the New Testament. It's interesting that some people don't think that Islam recognizes Christianity. Islam actually believes that Jesus Christ will return. He thinks that Christ is a prophet that will return to straighten the Jews out, and that Muhammad will return and help set up other things. They see Jesus Christ as a prophet similar to Muhammad, just not as great. And then Muhammad speaks to Allah about the precepts of Islam, and then from that, the Quran supposedly is written. But interesting where it is that Muhammad supposedly ascended from. It was a rock on top of Mount Moriah, the same place where we know that just a few feet away would have been the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. So this space now that was so important to so many stories in Israel is now under the control of another major religion that also has religious historical ties. And now you can see the conflicts starting to develop even further. Let's go forward further in history. July 15th, 1099, Jerusalem, which was under the control of the Muslim forces, falls to the Crusaders after a five-week siege. And the victors proceed to massacre not only the city's Muslims, but those few Jews that were allowed to return. After 460 years of Muslim rule, the Crusaders restored Jerusalem to Christian hands. And guess what they do? They start wiping out some of the things that the Muslims had, and they start setting up their own. But the Dome of the Rock stays. The Jewish and Muslim inhabitants were replaced by European and Eastern Christians, and then in 1219, the Jews were allowed to return. This was the first time that there was a migration of Jewish people back in to the city of Jerusalem. They had not been allowed in Jerusalem for over 900 years, and now they were allowed to start coming back. In 1260 AD, the Mamluk rulers of Egypt conquer Palestine, and they become the new masters of Jerusalem. Since they had accepted a form of Islam, they felt a deep commitment to that religion, and it is reflected on the intense building project in Jerusalem that has left its mark, and some would say its scar, on the old city to this day, particularly the Temple Mount. Any of you who've been there know that it's broken into four quadrants. There's a Jewish section, and an Armenian section, and a Christian section, and a Palestinian section. Just being in that area, you can recognize, you can go from the, as an example, the Jewish section into the Palestinian section, and it's just like the architecture changes within 2 feet. And you can see the different influences from the people. So, around the Temple Mount area, again, the Mamluk rulers in 1260 take over. But then, in 1517, the Ottoman Turks defeat the Mamluk forces, and Palestine now comes under the rule of a new empire that would dominate the Near East for almost 400 years. In the 15th and 16th centuries, there is again an influx of Jews that had been expelled. And then, on December 9th, 1917, as World War I neared its end, Jerusalem surrenders to the British forces. And in 1920, we have a mandate civil administration that takes over this time, the first time since the Crusader days of Jerusalem, that again, Jerusalem becomes the capital of the country. It's a very interesting time. I think if you go on Life, Hope, and Truth, you can read some articles about this. A lot of the Muslims and even a lot of the Christians felt that the British mishandled this so that they thought that Jerusalem was going to be restored to its former glory. But there were backdoor deals that were made by British ambassadors, et cetera, that caused a lot of concern and consternation, and it kept the tension in this area rising. In fact, the tension between the Jews and the Arabs erupted several times, 1920, 1929. There was an Arab revolt in 1936 that lasted for 3 years. So this area was indeed at the center of a firestorm. But something happened in 1948. I'm showing you a picture here. You won't be able to read it, I doubt. Well, maybe you can. This is a letter from David Ben-Gurion, the head of the Jewish Agency. In 1948, they proclaimed the establishment of the nation of Israel. Actually, they called it the State of Israel. This is a letter that they sent to the U.S. President, Harry S. Truman, and Harry Truman recognized the new nation on the same day that he received the letter. So the United States, Britain, and many other countries recognized the right of the nation of Israel, or the State of Israel, to exist, and it started in 1948. Now, you can imagine, for one side of the fence, this was a really happy time, and for the other side of the fence, this was a cause for more skirmish and war. This, again, is the letter that was sent to Harry Truman. As soon as hostilities ceased in 1949, government offices and the Knesset were transferred to Jerusalem, and the nation of Israel is reborn, as it were, after not being a nation for a couple of thousand years, even preceding Roman rule. And they are finally back into Jerusalem as the leaders of their own nation. Skirmishes go on for a long time. This is a very interesting picture. This is from 1967. In June of 1967, there was a war that occurred. It's now famously called the Six-Day War. I think that if you read through this, there was the Jordanians and the Egyptians and others felt that they could come in at a time when the Jewish nation wasn't prepared and take over. And yet, in a matter of 6 days, Israel not only retained its right to be a nation, as it were, political and municipal problems notwithstanding, the city now had Jews, Christians, and Muslims, secular people living side by side. And in 1967, they actually retook the Temple Mount. There are dozens and dozens of pictures of Moshe, Diane, and others that went up to the Temple Mount, and they were so excited to now have again in their possession the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite and Mount Moriah. And yet, within a matter of days, in their infinite wisdom, the Jewish Knesset decided to keep peace. They would turn the Temple Mount back over to the Arabs. And they did. And the Arabs have control of that to this day. The area right below the Temple Mount was considered Jewish, and all around it, and the Jewish quarter was considered Jewish, etc. But the Temple Mount and the area right around there was returned back to Arab control, where it still remains to this day. Now, you may recognize a couple of figures in here. Since that time, there have been numerous archaeological excavations that have been conducted at the site. A lot of what we have, we now draw from these archaeological digs, simply because a lot of the history, once the Mamluks and the Ottoman Turks and others took over, any history of what the Jewish people or the Israeli people may have had was erased. Dr. Benjamin Mazar, you see him in the upper left-hand corner, and his granddaughter, Elliot Mazar. Dr. Benjamin Mazar was the focus of a lot of articles in the Plain Truth magazine back in the day, which you might remember. Remember, Mr. Armstrong started the dig, as it came to be called. There probably are even some former Ambassador College students in the auditorium tonight or will be with us tomorrow who were on this dig, where they would go for a month or two in the summer between classes and help dig out some of the ruins of the area around the Temple Mount. Mr. Armstrong met him on several occasions, and Mr. Armstrong always felt it was important to wear a suit and tie, so he always stood out in a crowd. And you can see him with Dr. Mazar, and he's going through and looking at several of the sites and where the Ambassador College students would be digging. If you ever go to Jerusalem, on the south side, where there is a set of stairs, that's where a lot of the work of the Ambassador College students was done. It was just this kind of a grassy knoll, not to try and draw an allusion to Dallas, Texas, but there was this grassy area, and they dug that down and found steps that used to lead up to the south entrance of the Temple Mount. So many of our Ambassador College students were allowed to do that. Again, we have many people still alive today that worked on that dig. Now I want to go pause for a moment in this story, and I want to rehearse a couple of things about the Temple Mount. I want to talk about the various projects. The drawings that I'm going to show you, as you can see down in the corner, are from a book called Quest for the Temple by Lean Rittmeyer. This is one of the most fascinating books that I have ever read. He has a very exquisite way of explaining where he believes that the Temple Mount and the Holy of Holies was. And he was one of the people that worked under Benjamin Mazar and then later under Elliot Mazar. So he is an archaeologist that has been intimately involved with this project for years. But I want to kind of go through the history of it. This is a drawing of where Solomon's temple would have been. Now, when it was originally a hill and there was an outcrop of rock at the very top, that rock was the center where the Holy of Holies would have been. And then the altar would have been a few feet in front of that, just downhill. What Solomon did was, because it was a knoll and there was a rock at the top, and he wanted the temple to sit on the top of that rock, he erected walls on the side, retaining walls, and then he flattened the top of the mountain out to be a square, 500 cubits by 500 cubits. You actually can still find where those 500 by 500 cubits is, if you look through Dr. Rittmeyer's book. So he leveled this retaining wall out. The temple was built so that the Holy of Holies rested on that outcropping of rock. And the altar, and I'll show you a picture again. This is just a rendition of it. The altar is that big thing in the front. The altar would have sat in front of the temple where the Holy of Holies would have been. That altar is where the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite was. That altar would be where Abraham sacrificed Isaac. So the altar in front of the building was there. Years later, when we are in the intertestamental period, you see this orange area that's added to it. This is called the Hasmonean extension to the temple platform. This occurred in the 2nd century BC. And you physically can see where that is. When you know where the original 500 by 500 cubits is, there is a bend in the wall at the spot where this orange extension takes place. They couldn't, interestingly enough, they were trying to figure out why they wouldn't have continued on straight. Come to find out after doing some excavations that there was no good bedrock to form this retaining wall on, so they had to bend it out a little bit to find bedrock to be able to put this wall. That's fortunate for us, because now we can see where that original 500 cubit square was and where the extension is. So again, we have this drawing of what it would have been like when the Hasmoneans extended. This would have been Solomon's original temple and then the rebuild of Ezra before it was finally destroyed. Then comes along Herod, and this is Herod's extension. Now you can see the original yellow area here is the original Temple Mount area, and this is what Herod did to it. He expanded it into its present 37 acres. On the north side would have been the Antonia Fortress, the south side, Solomon's Stables. There were many entrances to it. It must have been a very beautiful area. This is what the disciples would have shown Jesus Christ and said, look at the magnificence of this building project. And that's when Jesus Christ said, it's all going away. That building that's sitting on the top of that rock is going to get wiped out. And it's exactly what happened. This is a drawing or a model that was made of what it would have looked like. Again, Solomon's Stables are to the lower left, and the temple is in the center. Would have been a beautiful. Josephus says that when the sun glint off of the polished stone, the polished limestone rock, that you could see it from miles away. It looked like the top of the mountain was on fire. You could see it for 20, 30 miles away, and it was just absolutely gorgeous. But after it's destroyed, now we see the Ottoman Turks come in, we see the Mamluks come in, we see the influence of the Muslim Arabs come in. The temple is not there anymore, although the platform still is, and the Dome of the Rock is built on it, as well as the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which you can see off to the left, or off to the right. So this area is now enlarged, and its present configuration, if you were to take a look at it from the air, this is what you see. The Dome of the Rock is in the center. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is on the south side, and I'm going to point with a laser pointer. I've got to turn away from the microphone for a minute. Right there is the stairs that the Ambassador College students did in the dig that they dug up. It's very interesting to go see that. That whole area has been dug now and is a museum that you can go and look and see where the original shops would have been. You read in the Bible where vendors would sell turtle doves and pigeons and whatnot. I'm sure they also sold grains and breads and things. There was a market that was all around this area. Very interesting to go back and look at that now. But what about the future? Let's go into the future now. We've been an hour into this Bible study. We know from Scripture that this area will be a central focal point for many conflicts at the close of the age. In fact, it's a central point of many problems right now. But prophecy also tells us that this area will once again be the center of God's throne and God's rule. Let's read about that. Let's go to Ezekiel chapter 40 and read verses 1 and 5. This is God revealing something to Ezekiel. In the visions of God, he took me into the land of Israel, and he set me on a very high mountain. And on it, toward the south, was something like the structure of a city. And then you drop down to verse 5, it says, and there was a wall all around the outside of the temple. What temple? There isn't one. We know, again, that Ezekiel was writing about a temple, but to what temple will the Messiah return? There isn't one there now. I want to show you a quote from the New Bible Dictionary. This is the people who were listening to the prophecies of Ezekiel. It says, the exiles were heartened in their grief by the vision of a new temple granted to Ezekiel. More details, this is important, more details are given of this temple than any of Solomon's structure. But this temple was never built. We know it wasn't built. Some people would look at this and say, no, this was the temple that Solomon built, or this was the temple that Herod would have built. There are 9 chapters that go into explicit detail of how this temple was to look. That temple was never built. Solomon's temple did not look like this. Herod's reconstruction did not look like this. This is a temple that has never been built. And yet there's 9 chapters dedicated to it. Why would God spend so much real estate in the Bible discussing something that doesn't exist? Unless there's a reason for it. Let's talk a little bit about what the future holds for this piece of real estate again. Ezekiel chapter 40 and verse 4. The man said to me, this is an angel talking to Ezekiel, "Son of man, look with your eyes, hear with your ears, and fix your mind on everything that I will show you. For you were brought here so that I might show them to you. Declare to the house of Israel everything you see." God, in the start of this amazing 9-chapter prophecy, wants the people of Israel to have a vision of something that's going to happen in the future. But what would it be? Could this be that it's describing a temple that is yet to be built when Jesus Christ returns? Let's read about it. I want to show you something that I think is very interesting. This is from the Jewish prayer book. They recognize why they're not in control of the Temple Mount right now. It says, "Because of our sins, we were exiled from our country. We were banished from our land. We cannot go up as pilgrims to worship you or perform our duties in your chosen house, the great and holy temple, which is called by your name, on account of the hand that was let loose on your sanctuary." They know why it happened. They know it was because of their sins. "May it be the will, Lord our God and God of our fathers, merciful King, in your abundant love again, to have mercy on us and on your sanctuary, to rebuild it speedily and magnify its glory." The Jewish people, if you've looked at any of what's happening in Jerusalem right now, are ready to rebuild this at the drop of a hat. They've got it all ready. They've got the cornerstone ready. They've got the menorah ready. They've got all of the gold accoutrements ready. They are ready to have a temple again. They're just being blocked. Every year they go to the Knesset and they ask for permission to storm up to the Temple Mount and take over the Dome of the Rock. And every year, obviously, they're told, no, we don't want to start World War III, but they're ready to. Let me show you a couple of interesting prophecies. This is Daniel chapter 8, verse 11 and 12. Here are some things that we know will happen in the future. Daniel 8, "By him the daily sacrifices will be taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth to the ground, and he did all of this and prospered." What daily sacrifices? They're not doing it now. Haven't done it for thousands of years. But it will happen again. There will come a time when the sacrificial system will again start up in Israel. That has led some to believe that the temple has to be rebuilt before the return of Jesus Christ, because the sacrifices are going to occur. We know from the book of Daniel that this is prior to the return of Christ. Does this tell us that a temple will be built before Christ returns? Let's go a little further. Let's look at what Jesus Christ himself said in Matthew 24. "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet," where is the abomination of desolation going to be? "Standing in the holy place." What holy place? There isn't one. "Whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." Is this a temple? Remember, brethren, that most of the sacrifices that are mentioned in the Bible occurred before a temple was ever built. To have a holy place, what did you need? You needed an altar. I told you I'd come back to that word. It was the altar that Abraham sacrificed Isaac. There wasn't a temple. There was an altar where David built when the angel stayed his hand, or God stayed the hand of the angel. There was an altar that was built by Solomon in front of the temple. In fact, in Ezra chapter 3, if you read, I won't turn there, but if you read through Ezra 3, it says that before they started to rebuild the temple after they came back from Babylonian captivity, the first thing they did was set the altar up so that they could cleanse the place so that they could rebuild the temple. In truth, there may be a temple rebuilt, but at the very least, there needs to be an altar. And it may happen that there is an altar there before there is a temple. Could this be an indication of what might happen in the future? I want to show you a couple of things here. For those of you that have never looked at this, there are tons of websites out there that are dedicated to the rebuilding of a third temple. They are planning to rebuild this on the model that is found in Ezekiel chapter 40 through 49. Why would they do that? Because they know the prophecies in Ezekiel 40 through 49, as we're going to read in just a moment, point to the return of the Messiah. In their mind, this temple needs to be set up before Messiah will return. So the longer we wait to put it up, the longer Messiah is going to be delayed in coming back. I just want to read what's in the upper right-hand corner of this website. This is the Temple Mount Faithful Movement. It says, the goal of the Temple Mount and Land of Israel Faithful Movement is the building of the third temple on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem in our lifetime, according to the word of God and all the Hebrew prophets, and the liberation of the Temple Mount from Arab occupation so that it may be consecrated to the name of God. There are people that are there ready to do that right now. This is a picture that I took. I told you to look at the menorah that was on the Arch of Titus. They have rebuilt the menorah out of solid gold. It's on display. When I was in Israel in 2005, they had it just outside the Temple Mount area. Highly protected and highly guarded, obviously, but they have built all of this. If you look at, and it's a little hard to see, but there's a sign by it on the right. At the bottom of that sign, it says, At the time it is brought to its proper place within the sanctuary, it shall be sanctified, this menorah, for the divine service of the holy temple. May it be rebuilt speedily and in our days. Interestingly enough, for those of you that have ever gone there and you try and walk up onto the Temple Mount, according to Torah law, you shouldn't do that. They're not 100% sure in their mind exactly where the Holy of Holies was, so they don't want anybody up there because you might step on and desecrate the Holy of Holies, even though it's not there now. Now, our perspective, the Holy of Holies is where God's presence is, and God's presence isn't there right now. But will there be a temple before Christ returns, or will there be a temple after Christ returns? I'll put another drawing up of what Ezekiel's temple looks like. This is, again, a rendition of someone reading through Ezekiel 40 through 49. You know, brethren, we are here at the Feast of Tabernacles to celebrate in advance the coming millennial reign of Jesus Christ. What I'd like to do to finish off today in the next few slides is to read more about what that will be like. Because of the specifics of Ezekiel 40 through 49, I believe that we can safely conclude that there will be a temple that will be rebuilt at some point in time. We don't know exactly when. We don't know if it'll get rebuilt before Christ returns or after. But it is very clear from Scripture that there will be a temple for Jesus Christ to reign from. Let's look at some of these things. Ezekiel chapter 43, this is in the middle of that prophecy again, verses 4 through 6. Notice what happens once again. The glory of the Eternal came into the temple by way of the gate which faces toward the east. The Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court. And behold, the glory of the Eternal filled the temple. And I heard him speaking to me from the temple while a man stood beside me. This is obviously speaking about the return of Jesus Christ. And it is obviously speaking about the presence of God returning to this site. There will come a time, we know, that Jesus Christ will return. He'll land on the Mount of Olives. The mount will split in two, and it says that he will rule from Jerusalem. Ezekiel 43 tells us that the center of this rule is going to be in a new temple. Let's read a little bit more about this. I thought this was interesting. I wanted to show you this picture. It really has nothing to do with the Bible study other than I think it's interesting. Many people realize, and they can also read the Old Testament, that there is a prophecy that the Messiah would return. There also is a prophecy that says that Elijah will return prior to the Messiah. And in their kind of way of thinking, if we can keep Elijah from returning, then the Messiah can't return because the prophecies say that Elijah has to come first. So what did they do? They built a graveyard in front of the east gate of the Temple Mount area. Now, why would they do that? Let me show you an interesting scripture. Leviticus 21, verse 1. The Eternal said to Moses, speak to all of the priests, of which Elijah would be one, the sons of Aaron, and tell them, a priest must not make himself unclean by going near a dead body. So, I'm reading this. I'm quoting again. The Ottomans built a cemetery in front of the east gate in the belief that the precursor to the anointed one, Elijah, would not be able to pass through the golden gate, and thus the anointed one would not be able to come. This belief was based on the Islamic teaching that Elijah is a descendant of Aaron, making him a priest, and that a Jewish priest was not permitted to enter a cemetery. So in front of the Golden Gates or the East Gate of the Temple Mount to this day is an Islamic cemetery, thinking that somehow that's going to stop Jesus Christ from being able to return. So give you that as a little bit of interesting fodder for your discussions tonight when you go home. Ezekiel chapter 43, verses 7 and 12. Let's read a little bit further. He said to me, "Son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever." Verse 12, the whole area surrounding this mountaintop is holy. When Jesus Christ returns, Ezekiel tells us he will return to this temple. He will come through the east gate. The presence of God will be there, and he will be on that mountaintop ruling over the children of Israel forever. Once again, Mount Moriah will be the central place of worship during the millennium. This time, the place where God places his name won't be overthrown by the enemies of God. They'll try. You can read that Gog and Magog will try again and take it over, but it won't happen. This site, which has been used by God many times during the history of the people of God, will once again have the presence of God and be holy. Ezekiel chapter 47, verses 1 and then 6 through 9. Then he brought me back to the door of the temple, and there was water flowing from under the threshold of the temple toward the east. For the front of the temple faced east, and water was flowing from under the right side of the temple, south of the altar. This place where the altar was is where this water is going to start flowing. Verse 6, then he brought me and returned me to the bank of the river. And he said to me, "This water flows toward the eastern region and goes down into the valley and enters the sea. When it reaches the sea, its waters are healed. And it will be that every living thing that moves, wherever the rivers go, will live." We sing of this all the time. Remember the hymn that we sing, "Rivers of Living Water"? That was written as a result of this area in Ezekiel 47. What we are singing about is that the Dead Sea will one of these days be made alive. Now, I want to tell you another little story here. This is another little tidbit of information. When Ross Judson wrote that song, actually before he wrote that song, Mr. Armstrong called him up one day and he said, "Ross, I'd like for you to meet me at the base of this one particular area on the Ambassador College campus." So Ross went out there to meet him, and he says, "I'm going to build a stream, and it's going to come down on the right side. I'm going to have a rock here, and there's going to be a little waterfall, etc. And at the dedication, I want you to perform your song, 'Rivers of Living Water.'" And Ross said, "I'm not familiar with that song." Mr. Armstrong said, "That's because you haven't written it yet." That song that we sing is from that occurrence. Mr. Armstrong told him to write it. The healing water that will emanate from this very spot will heal the world. We know that that stream comes from right beside the altar. Zechariah chapter 8, verses 3 through 6. "Thus says the Eternal, I will return to Zion and dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Jerusalem will be called the city of truth." Won't that be wonderful, that it won't be called the city where everybody doesn't get along, or the city where the Muslims have this and the Jews have this and the Christians have that and the Armenians have this? "It will be called the city of truth, and it will be the mountain of the Eternal of Hosts." It will once again be the mountain of God. "Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, old men and old women will sit again at the streets of Jerusalem, each one with his staff in his hand because of great age. The streets of the city will be full of boys and girls playing in the streets, for thus says the Eternal of Hosts, if it is marvelous in the eyes of the remnant of this people in these days, will it also be marvelous in my eyes, says the Lord of Hosts." Once again, this will be the holy mountain of God. From here, he will rule during the millennium. The streets will be safe, and all will enjoy the peaceful city. So, brethren, I hope that this has helped focus our attention on the place where Jesus Christ will rule during the millennium. That's what we're here to picture. We're here to picture the millennial reign of Jesus Christ. Can you imagine him ruling from a new temple in Jerusalem? The same place where so many things have happened in the past for the people of God. So many times where the presence of God has been with his people. This special place chosen by God has an amazing past. God has used it mightily in ways even during this present age. But when he returns again, this very spot is going to be the center of the millennial reign of Jesus Christ. Godspeed that day. Thanks for coming. Hope you all have a safe trip back and a good night's sleep. And we will see you tomorrow at 2 o'clock for services and 11 o'clock for teen and young adult Bible studies.